KALW.
I was just fascinated by the idea that a 3-pound bag of Jell-O between our ears could sort of produce all of our experiences and all of ourself.
A Stanford researcher studies our brains and the emotion of empathy.
How do we understand each other, and why are we so good at it? Why are we sometimes so bad at it? And can we get better at it?
And can we teach it? Then we'll meet a man on his way out of prison.
There's a mixture of emotions, excitement, gratitude. I'm trying to keep it all in within me.
Finding freedom. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. It seems to a lot of us today that our society is lacking empathy for other points of view that may not be ours, especially in politics, but also when we talk about race or gender or even sports. We often discount the feelings and experiences of people who are different. And while it seems that's just the way society is, there may be a solution: teaching empathy. Jamil Zeki heads Stanford's Social Neuroscience Lab, and he's been studying empathy. And his research has shown that, contrary to prior thinking, empathy is not a fixed trait, but a skill that we can learn and be trained on. He writes about this in his new book, The War for Kindness: Building Empathy in a Fractured World. I called him up to ask how it works. For your book, you interviewed a number of people, and one of them was a neo-Nazi. And he is no longer a neo-Nazi, but I want you to kind of tell us about how you met this person, why you interviewed him for this book, and what's the outcome?
Well, I mean, in part, I did think that if you want to really take seriously the idea that empathy and caring are teachable skills, you should look at the hardest case that you can find. Somebody who was just the opposite of kind and empathic, at least at some point in their life, and see how much someone can change. I met Tony McAleer because, in fact, his organization, which is called Life After Hate, contacted me and some other psychologists. They wanted to learn more about the science of empathy. Mm. And I said, well, okay, I'm happy to talk about that. I want to learn more about you and how you got to where you are. Tony was somebody who was really, had a neglectful family, or at least his father was very neglectful of him when he was growing up in Vancouver. And he ended up just a really angry, alienated kid. I mean, let's be clear, the vast majority of angry, alienated kids do not become neo-Nazis, thankfully. And Tony mm-hmm. takes full responsibility for his choices in life. But, you know, he did become, you know, this horribly racist, anti-Semitic, xenophobic person, and that hatred consumed him and drove his life for, up until he was in his mid-20s. Mm. But he was able to reform. He was able to come back from that and now sort of leads this movement to help other people get out of a life of hate that he once inhabited.
So I guess my next question is, you say empathy is teachable, and you speak to somebody who indeed kind of changed their lives. How is it teachable? How do you teach it? What do you do?
Well, the first step to teaching empathy, or to, let's say to learn it, right? Let's imagine that most of your listeners are wanting to learn it themselves. Well, the first step is to realize that you can learn it. You might have heard of my colleague Carol Dweck at Stanford has this mm-hmm. idea of growth versus fixed mindsets. Mm-hmm. The idea is that our beliefs about ourselves shape the way that we face challenges. So she found, for instance, if you tell students, kids, that their intelligence is fixed, that they can never change how smart they are, they don't work as hard when they face a difficult math problem, for instance, because mm-hmm. they're like, well, I'll never be smarter, and I don't want to kind of fail at this because it will show how unsmart I am.
Right.
But if you teach kids that intelligence is instead something that they can grow, they take that same difficult problem and they're like, great, this is like a workout for my brain, right, basically. Mm. And Carol and I have found that the same is true for empathy, right? So when you convince people or tell them that empathy is a skill, they actually work harder at it, especially in cases where it might be difficult. So, for instance, they spend more time listening to the stories of somebody who's a different race than them. Mm-hmm. And they spend more energy trying to understand the opinions of someone they disagree with politically. So the first step, right, to learning or teaching empathy is establishing that it can be learned and can be taught. Sometimes just thinking that we can't change becomes a barrier to that exact change.
Mm. You have to want to learn empathy, right?
Yeah.
That seems like it's a key in this experiment. Intent.
I totally agree. And that's a really important point, right? I mean, we have a lot of skills that we don't use, right? Like most of us can run, but most of us don't run marathons, right?
So, nope.
I certainly don't, right? And so it's not just about the ability to do something. It's about the drive to do it, the desire, the willingness, and you put this really nicely. And so that's one of the things that in my research I look a lot at is like, what are the forces that make people want to empathize? And what are the forces that make them not want to empathize? And how can we sort of change those forces, push them around in ways that make people want to empathize more? I'll give you an example, right? Mm. When people think that the world around them is cruel, they feel like it's pointless to empathize. Why should I care if people around me don't care? And what I found in my research is that indeed, if you convince people or show them examples of people around them being kind and empathic, they're more motivated to be kind and empathic because they want to fit in. But if you show them examples of people being cruel and callous, they also want to fit in, and so they act in more selfish ways. Mm. We ran an experiment in middle schools where we had middle schoolers write about why they valued empathy. Then we collated all their responses. Why? So that when they came back to school the next day, we could give them a brochure, which was all of their friends and classmates saying why they valued empathy, why they liked to empathize. We weren't making something up. We were pointing these students towards the actual social reality around them, which is that they were surrounded by caring. But we found that that made them actually act in more kind ways even 2 months later.
Oh, wow. And what an age group to test this on. Let me just say I have a middle schooler, and it's notoriously an age of meanness, a lot of meanness and, you know, just like bullying and all of this. So that's a good age group to test this on. If you can make middle schoolers empathize, then you have done a lot. So what do you want the average person who reads your book to get out of this to gain?
Well, you know, I hope that a reader will be empowered, right? I feel like we're living in a time when a lot of us feel really emotionally disenfranchised, where there's just this culture of extreme division, intolerance, even open hatred, and of loneliness, isolation, and stress. I mean, basically, like, we're more atomized than we ever have been before. And we have fewer opportunities to really connect with each other. And many of those opportunities, like on Twitter, for instance, are not structured in ways that allow for great and productive conversation that often. And I think that it's warping our sense of who we are. You know, we feel as though empathy is on the decline. And it is, by the way. The surveys suggest that we are less empathic than we were even 30 years ago as a culture. And I kind of feel like many people have sort of become hopeless and helpless and feel like, hey, that's just who we are. We're headed down this path to becoming crueler and less connected over time, and it's inevitable. In fact, since I wrote this book, I've heard from hundreds of people who want a more empathic culture but feel that they're alone. Mm. So I want people to realize that they're not alone and that there is something that they can do about it. Right? That we can learn to empathize better. We can learn to connect better. Even if you do that as an individual, you stand to gain because empathy helps people in all sorts of ways.
And what can an individual do in their own home, in their own community? They don't have to go to like the Stanford lab that you head, right?
Of course.
What kinds of tools can you give people?
Yeah, I mean, so again, the first thing is to realize that you can grow. Then how do you grow? What are the right practices and habits to develop? Well, I mean, science suggests a bunch of options. It turns out that there are meditation practices like compassion meditation that people have been using for thousands of years. But now neuroscientists have demonstrated not only do those practices make us better, more effective empathizers, they actually change our brain in the process, even sort of growing parts of our brain that are associated with empathy. Another sort of tool that's available to all of us is our imaginations, right? So it turns out that reading fiction or attending theater, right, not only allows us to imagine fictional people and connect with them, it actually opens and broadens our empathy for people who are different from ourselves in all sorts of ways. Mm. And then another thing that we can do is to try to connect with real people, not just fictional ones, right? I mean,
or not just people online.
Yes.
Behind screens. What do you think about all of that? Social media and especially young people. I'm going to sound like the old curmudgeon. But did you study at all kind of being stuck to devices and communicating virtually, how to create empathy when you are not, you know, meeting people in person a lot? You're not talking to people on the phone a lot. Your communication with people, a lot of it is, you know, on a screen and you're typing.
It's true. And, you know, I mean, the way I think of it is that the internet and social media in particular are humanity's greatest empathic opportunity that we've ever had. I know it doesn't sound that way. It doesn't seem that way now. But I mean, think of it. We can connect with anybody, anywhere, anytime on their own terms and respond with empathy. And if you read like Wired from 2010 or something, people were over the moon with the global community we were all going to create. And now that just seems laughable, right? Mm. What went wrong? You know, I think that part of it is the way that social media platforms are constructed, which is not to keep users happy or connected, but just to keep them online by whatever means necessary. Mm. So that they'll click on ads and so forth. And I think oftentimes what that means is that those platforms are best suited to our weaknesses, our frailties, right? Vanity, anger, fear, intolerance, and difference. And so sometimes, you know, so when I look at Twitter, for instance, what do I see? Well, I see that we don't have access to cues about people that might spark empathy. We can't see their faces. We can't hear their voices. We can't hear their stories. All we have are these quick, just strips of text. What do we have? Well, we have a system where we are rewarded with likes and retweets. And it turns out that research has demonstrated we're most rewarded when we express outrage towards people who are different from ourselves. And who rewards us? The people who already agree with us. Huh. So basically, we are in this ecosystem where we are seeing less of each other and being rewarded for doing things that dehumanize and sort of express intolerance towards others. So basically, social media could have been a great sort of source of empathy, and instead it gets in the way. I don't think that it necessarily gets in the way. And I think that there are ways that we can change our online interactions to make them more empathy positive, but we haven't done that yet.
Jamil Zaki, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jamil Zaki, head of Stanford's Social Neuroscience Lab. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, we've got a story from the Uncuffed team at Solano State Prison in Vacaville.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
Until recently in California, you could get a life sentence for murder even if you didn't kill anyone, and even if you didn't plan to kill anyone. The old felony murder rule, as it was called, said that if someone died while you were committing a felony, like a robbery, you were guilty of murder. That rule was recently changed under a bill called SB 1437. Now, people charged under the old law can get their sentences reduced. Here's Uncuffed producer Spoon Jackson.
The Reed brothers, Jesse and Greg, came to prison as crime partners. Jesse was the shooter, and his little brother, Greg, was just there to rob and did not know someone would get killed, and both were convicted of felony murder. Greg was given 26 years to life.
1437, as it reads, is accomplice liability for felony murder. Felony murder itself just says that when two people go out to do a crime and one of those people that's doing that felony commits a murder, all of those individuals who intended the underlying felony, whether it be burglary or robbery, are equally guilty. In my case, was tried and convicted. And the DA used a theory. That theory is the felony murder, and the felony murder rule. And it says that I am as responsible as the trigger man.
Did you foresee yourself coming to prison?
I didn't. And now looking back, it's obvious, but I didn't at that time, no.
Where did you think you were headed?
I wasn't anywhere in particular. I was just treading water, and that was fine with me. At that time, I would get out, find some adventure or something to entertain myself. I was a thief at that time in my life, and so what fed that is that I never had enough. I'd steal something, and then I'd have to have some more. And I had an unhealthy relationship with my brother because I believed that loyalty meant that I agreed with whatever he said, and it was just me and him against the world.
So, and specifically, it said that if you intended to kill, even though you didn't kill,
right,
you still is culpable.
That's exactly
so you
right.
had no intent to kill or anything.
No intent to kill. My brother, older brother, had a gun. We approached someone to rob. He pulled a gun. I supported him, and that when the person said that I didn't have any money, I attempted to get the money. My older brother, had a weapon, and he shot and killed a man.
How long have you been incarcerated?
Mr. Spoon, I've been incarcerated since 1985, June, 33 years. So eventually, when I was walking down up the ramp to my cell, all the fun was over, all the get high was over, and nothing but trouble. That's all I had left, so I had to face that.
You didn't know what to expect, huh?
No, not at all. I had the sense that I was the new guy and that I was—
All eyes on you.
All eyes on me, yeah.
Okay. So that dark stuff that you was doing while you was in prison,
right,
when did you completely let that go?
I hadn't. It wasn't an overnight thing.
I know.
So I was still smoking weed. I still had this idea that I could solve problems with violence. I was angry, as I said already. And I was trying to find my way. I felt picked on when I came into the system. One of the things I had the toughest time with is being called a murderer. And I felt like it was disrespectful or I was being mistreated. Then all of that anger came up and I pushed back. Jesse was given a parole date in 2008 and he paroled in 2009.
Okay, where were you at that time?
He was at San Quentin at the time and I was here at Solano.
Why was you still at Solano Level 3 and he was at San Quentin Level 2?
Well, there's a disciplinary, it's called 115s. I had a lot of 115s and I had not been that concerned about him, to tell you the truth, because I felt justified.
What year did Jesse get out?
Jesse was paroled in 2009, because I knew in my heart I hadn't murdered anybody. I didn't intend to murder anybody. So when staff would say in classification, or if they were dealing with me, they dealt with me as my label suggested. I'm a murderer.
3 months have passed, and Greg Reed has gone back to court and had his sentence reduced. And I will let him tell you in his own words what happened.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me back again. The last time that we had talked, that time I had submitted my petition to the sentencing court, Alameda County. 1437 said my petition has to be granted if it's found that I was not a major participant and did not act with reckless indifference to human suffering.
And the court determined that that was true?
That was true for me. I didn't intend to kill. This was May 4th or 5th, somewhere around there, 2019. She said, look, I met with the judge. They're offering a deal. And what they want is to have you to accept a manslaughter charge, time served.
How are you feeling right at this moment after 34 years, knowing that you may hit the streets any moment now?
There's a mixture of emotions, excitement, gratitude.
Let me tell you, did some light just pop on at the end of that tunnel?
It did. I'm trying to keep it all in within me. I think what'll happen is that once it becomes even more clear, I'm probably going to cry like a baby because it's kind of being stuffed inside. I've gone through a whole period of time for all these years of this hopefulness, and then that hopefulness is snatched away. So, okay, the shooter was home. The victim's family had forgiven me.
34 years, man. Don't you want to holler or something, man?
I want to remind the audience that I've known Spoon Jackson. He's been a mentor to me, a friend to me, way back to saying when I first started out.
Well, take me with you.
The fact is that he's here with me as I move out the door is a blessing. It's incredible. You know, we're much older and we're much wiser now.
Speak for yourself. I'm still 30.
He never got past 29. Okay, that's good. Anyway, I appreciate that he's still fighting. And so for anyone listening that's still fighting, keep that fire in you.
Gregory Reed was released from prison in August. He spoke with Spoon Jackson, a producer in KELW's radio program at Solano State Prison. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitations. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at our website, kalw.org/uncuffed. And while you're on our website, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Tune in tomorrow at 5. We'll meet a woman who finally made it to Burning Man after years of being told she couldn't.
I have friends who've been coming for 20 years, and every year they would come home with pictures and stories, and it would always end with, oh, but you could never do Burning Man in a wheelchair. And I was dumb, and I listened to them.
Burning Man Mobility Camp, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. And before we leave, let's listen to some local music. This is New Zombies from Oakland. As a part of the Active Music series, they'll perform at the Uptown on Telegraph tomorrow night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sona Avakian, Janae Darden, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Jessica Plachik, Andrew Stelzer, Sarah Lai Sterland, and Eli Wurchapter. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tadek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.